Hello, friends. This is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Before I start this episode with Sarah Schulman, the novelist, essayist, playwright, advisory board member of Jewish Voice for Peace, and the list goes on, I want to go back to a quote that I brought to the show way back years ago on the very first episode. It's still important today, and it's from the Christian writer and philosopher G.K. Chesterton. Here it is. When the businessman rebukes the idealism of his office boy, it is commonly in some such speech as this. Ah, yes, when one is young, one has these ideals in the abstract and these castles in the air, but in middle age they all break up like clouds, and one comes down to a belief in practical politics, to using the machinery one has and getting on with the world as it is. But since then, I have grown up and have discovered that these philanthropic old men were telling lies. What has really happened is exactly the opposite of what they said would happen. They said that I should lose my ideals and begin to believe in the methods of practical politicians. Now, I have not lost my ideals in the least. My faith in fundamentals is exactly what it always was. What I have lost is my old childlike faith in practical politics. I am still as much concerned as ever about the Battle of Armageddon, but I am not so much concerned about the general election. The vision is always solid and reliable. The vision is always a fact. It is the reality that is often a fraud. Friends, right now, the state's refusal, and that is many states, to mediate in terms of Palestinian liberation in the face of a crisis of violence against Palestinians, especially in Gaza, has amplified both the need for the vision and practical action, and has amplified our visions and practical actions around the crisis. A vision of total liberation from war and state violence, and the practical actions, tactics, strategies to force the hand of certain regulations, laws, embargoes, and who's in power and who is held accountable. Moving back and forth from vision to practical action has for a long time been a difficult dance. And I'm wondering if it's becoming easier, if it's becoming more obvious that this needs to happen. When I was doing a lot of sex workers' rights activism, I was constantly trying to balance the two modes of changing the world. Holding the tone of the vision at all times, in that case sexual liberation and the abolition of work, and the on-the-ground activism that was needed to secure safety for sex workers, to change the quality of life for the better, to stop horrible regulations that would affect sex workers' lives, and so on and so forth. And doing that dance was something that was even seen as an ethical problem for some other activists who thought, well, if you're focusing on the vision, then you just got your head in the clouds, like the G.K. Chesterton thing, castles in the clouds. Or people that thought, well, you're not really thinking big enough, and therefore I'm going to critique your actions. This is actually pretty foundational to the classic clash between Marxists and anarchists. And you can pick either side. You can say that the anarchists are the dreamers and the Marxists are practical, or vice versa. But this has been a long-standing problem between the two groups, who are otherwise somewhat aligned in some of what they do and what they dream. These are also questions of art. Maybe that sounds surprising, but I think about it all the time when I'm writing, and I think a lot of artists do. How do I tell a story but stay true to my imagination? How do I innovate but communicate through the mediums that others can understand? How can I express through the bizarre astral realm of the unconscious but meet it with the clarified step-by-step out-in-the-open mode of my consciousness, my everyday consciousness? Sarah Schulman's life and efforts in the cultural realm and in the political realm express this dance, I think, in a unique way, or a way that's unique to her. She's most known, I think, for books like Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community, Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. Also, Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 through 1993, and The Gentrification of the Mind, Witness to a Lost Imagination. These are powerful books. Sarah has a great gift of articulating things that are deeply felt, but nevertheless hard to communicate to others. That is, until she sets her concentration, her writing, and her communicative style to it. Sarah is also a very visible figure in the struggle for Palestinian liberation, particularly in the United States, and in ending the U.S.'s support for the Israeli state's violence against Palestinian people. All right, friends, this is the part where I tell you to go to patreon.com/ConnorHabib to support the show. I've gone through so many reasons why I use Patreon over all the episodes of this show, and maybe you're burned out from hearing this. Maybe you do support the show through Patreon. If you do, thank you very much. I really couldn't do it without you. Some of those reasons that I always state, though, I think they really are important. One is that it's not paying me for my labor. It's a different model of support where you are supporting someone's being in the world, really. It's not you put in this time, I pay you for this time, that very toxic wage labor relationship, but rather, hey, I see you and I appreciate what you do. Here's some support. Here's connection through that economic realm that really, at its best, can express a kind of kinship between us. It's also, you know, needed because I don't have any ads. People put ads in the beginning of podcasts. I could have been doing that for years. I don't do it because most ads suck. And most people have approached me to have sponsorships for the podcast also just suck. Their products suck. Their companies suck. They have nothing to do with what I'm doing or the integrity of the show. And I'd like to keep that going. And it's also just like, hey, I like this podcast. I get a lot of value from it in my life, or meaning in my life. If that's you, if it's inspiring conversations, if you're new to it and it's inspiring new thoughts, if it's introducing new thinkers and writers and concepts, great. Showing support through patreon.com/ConnorHabib is a great way to say this has value to me. Also, I mean, there are other things you can do. You can buy my novel, Hawk Mountain. You can give the podcast a warm review on Apple Podcasts, or give it a 5-star rating on Spotify. You can subscribe to it. You can just tell people about it. But I will say, all those things are great, but the Patreon is a much more direct way to do it. So whatever way you think you can support on Patreon, if you do already, thank you. If not, patreon.com/ConnorBeeb. I think some people are just Patreoned out, or worrying about their own finances or whatever. And so I understand that maybe it's all just kind of blurring together for people right now. But it's always great to receive that note of support from people that listen to the show. And thank you so much. Also, just for listening. A lot of people listen to the show, and that is incredible. Thank you. All right. Here's my conversation with Sarah Schulman. Hi, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Hello, Sarah Schulman. Nice to see you.
Hi.
So I just had to record an episode with Michael Hart. And, you know, in his book about the 70s and movements in the 70s, he keeps sort of mulling over this thing, which is like, you know, movements seem to be creating concepts. They seem to be creating new concepts. And
you know, I thought this was interesting because he's a Deleuze scholar and he, and, you know, Deleuze said philosophy's job is to create new concepts. But it attached to something that I heard you say a few times, which is that activism should open things up. It should create an opening for new pathways. And I just like this idea of the invention that's offered and the creation that's offered by movement and activist gestures. In times of, well, there's always a time of war, and I also don't want to call the Israel-Palestine events currently unfolding a war. But what when I think about what pathways are opened up or available to us, I think it's harder to see in times when we're feeling the urgent, pressing conflict that we're trying to just stop in the moment. So we would talk about the tension between those two things, opening up and just kind of getting cessation of violence, and how we could maybe not let go of one while trying to enact the other.
Well, you know, people and institutions act on and transform each other, right? So nothing is stagnant. And what we're seeing now is a paradigm shift, and a paradigm shift unfolds over time and has different phases. It's not an immediate change. So ideas that have been successfully repressed for decades are now popping to the surface because too many people hold them. And institutions of repression are trying, they're using their old tactics of like firing people or banning student organizations or saying you can't say from the river to the sea or whatever tactics they're using, but they don't work anymore because people won't accept them. So now we're in the part of the paradigm shift where they don't work anymore. So when Columbia University bans Jewish Voice for Peace, bans a Jewish student organization in order to protect Jews, okay, obviously so hypocritical that everyone in the world can see it's not about Jews, it's about Zionism. When that happens, and 4 days later, there's 44 student organizations forming a coalition protesting it, and there's a faculty walkout, it didn't work. It's not working. So now we're going to find out what's going to happen when it doesn't work. And, you know, all of this, these laws that the U.S. government is passing saying that it's illegal to say that a country, quote, shouldn't, quote, exist, or criticizing Israel equals anti-Semitism. These laws, these Orwellian laws that are just not true. Just because you pass it doesn't make it true. You know, this is not going to work for them, this strategy, because too many people oppose it. Now, in terms of the demand right now of the mass movement that is global, of hundreds of thousands, of literally millions of people marching in the streets and opposing this war, it is a war of Israel against Gaza. Mass movements create counterculture because people spend time with each other. And they talk, and they develop a collectivity, and they develop a community-based culture. And so there's a countercultural shift. Right now, the, quote, demand of the coalition is ceasefire. That is the coalitional demand. But many aspects or elements of the coalition go way beyond that demand. So like JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, their demand is permanent ceasefire. I think it's ceasefire permanently. Other people want an end to occupation and siege. Other people want a whole state called Palestine that, you know, other people like myself are one-staters. There's just a lot of different voices in that coalition. But right now, the thing that unites everyone is ceasefire, which they can't even maintain because as of this morning, the slaughter has resumed. So as with all things Palestine, the problem is there, we don't know where the tipping point is. The world opposes this war, and yet it has no impact on the ground. Palestinian people are being murdered, slaughtered, butchered, and it doesn't end. Even though people are resisting or rebelling against their governmental position, their government's positions. So that's where we are in the paradigm shift right now.
Yeah, maybe I'll take that last point first, where, you know, So I'm not Palestinian, I'm Syrian. My father's from Syria, and my mother's Irish, New Yorker. But I have felt for so long that, you know, I've been involved in this particular issue for a really long time, but I was in some ways, as horrible as this might sound at first, that I felt sort of relieved by the fact that so many people were out, you know, doing what they were doing. Cause I thought, well, my God, like, it doesn't feel like there's as much burden being carried by such a few amount of people. But then that immediately attuned me to the fact that this kind of mass movement seems to happen, you know, after a tremendous human sacrifice has been made. And so I've been trying to sort of hold that tension and think through it. And what the problem is that it's great. There is a moral and there is a heart lesson here that people are coming together in unprecedented numbers and visibility. And I also am now thinking, like, well, what is this problem where where a lot of us don't do this unless a tremendous human sacrifice has been made to this sort of God or notion of moving the needle, of getting people active? And I wanted to think about that with you. It's like, why is it that the action, this kind of massive action, happens in the face of tragedy? And on one hand, I would say it only seems natural. Of course. But on the other hand, I think, what is the obstruction there to taking?
Well, there's other elements, Connor. I mean, first of all, there's all the frontline Palestinians who have been practicing a politics of repetition for 75 years.
Yeah.
People have been saying over and over and over, they're incarcerating children. They're arresting children. They're putting children in prison. I've been hearing this. I mean, I haven't been in this movement longer than 15 years, so I'm new to it. But I've heard that consistently since I got into it. Finally, now people are like, oh my God, they've arrested children. You know, it's like one's been listening, but the politics of repetition sets foundations and is a necessary part of the moment when the zeitgeist will allow the paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you can't push it. You know, there's all these kind of vanguardist movements historically that try to push it, push the zeitgeist when it's not going to go. And they always self-destruct and end up very alienated. Mm. So you have to have that foundational community of all of these organizations and leaders and Palestinian journalists and activists and all of this and everything that they've been doing their whole lives to make this moment possible. The other thing is that, because, you know, there have been other massacres of Palestinians, as you well know. Sure. But we have Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it. And it's the only place you can hear, besides Al Jazeera, it's the only place you can actually hear Palestinians speak. So it's kind of like, what if the Vietnam War was unfolding on Twitter? Mm-hmm. It would have been a completely different experience. You wouldn't have needed to wait to get your Life magazine that came once a month to get your picture of a civilian child running naked down the street. Now we see every day what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. And so it's a people-to-people communication that is propelling this. The other thing that's going on is that the whole world doesn't work. You know, every community is in crisis. Every community is under attack. Nothing is functioning. So there's just a lot of disenchantment and anger everywhere. And once students get involved in something, and this reminds me of the movement against the war in Vietnam. So you had, at that time, Black Power movement, gay liberation, women's liberation. These were marginal radical movements. But when students get involved, who are middle class, even if they're not from middle class background, they're in a middle class structure, but these radical ideas become more mainstream. And that's where we are right now. So Palestine is the impetus, but it's about a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of this particular moment. I'm thinking also, you know, something you've said about and written about ACT UP is the way you phrase it is, again, you know, against the government's will or against the will of what was happening. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, it seems that there's this moment where the zeitgeist catches. And on the other hand, there seems to be, in the case of ACT UP, I don't know if you would put it this way. I'm just wondering where you distinguishing these two things. The idea of almost creating enough of a zeitgeist for it to catch. Because if on the one hand, we're seeing this, as you're saying, politics in action of repetition, and then something is able to ignite and catch in the popular understanding and imagination and heart. And on the other hand, there's one where it was this kind of, and continues to be, this battle that had to actually, as you said, force the issue, actually push until it was even recognized. And that was, that seemed to be a different kind of trajectory there.
Well, the thing is, ACT UP also had this pre-existing foundation, which was the gay community.
Yeah, right.
It just wasn't visible. But all this collectivity, all of these relationships, all of this self-understanding, political leaders, theory that had already been done, you know, all this kind of stuff that was already in place that allowed it to push into the public eye.
The spontaneity myth around these kinds of things, I understand that it's not ever spontaneous or almost never spontaneous. But I'm trying to understand the different kinds of non-spontaneity that could happen and how they work and how we can actually kind of reveal trajectories more often so that things don't seem spontaneous, so that we can actually see the work that's happening while it's happening a bit more and come to be awake to it as it's happening from the outside. Yeah, go ahead.
These organizations have been around for a long time and the media has never covered them. Like,
yeah.
Jewish Voice for Peace is old. Students for Justice in Palestine has been around a long time. Mm-hmm. I have yet to see any major media actually talk about how these organizations got founded, how long they've been, what their agenda has been, who is running them, who's on their boards. There's been no face put to any of this. I mean, the JVP has been recreating classic ACT UP actions. They recreated the Grand Central Action, the Manhattan Bridge. When they went to the New York Times, they did the New York Crimes, the fake newspaper, just like ACT UP did. So they're clearly reading the books and watching the films and stuff and using that playbook, because that movement is very queer, the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And they're placing themselves exactly in the trajectory of ACT UP, which is very moving. But no one has covered that. But there's other groups. Like, there's a group called Within Our Lifetime, which is a Palestinian group in New York. They're based in Bay Ridge. And you see them every time you see image of a demo. It's all these women in hijab with Palestinian flags with extremely left-wing slogan. Nobody has even mentioned that they exist. Mm-hmm. No one has interviewed their leadership. Nardine Kiswani, one of their leaders, graduated first in her class at CUNY Law School. Nobody has profiled her. You know, it's like they're keeping it all so murky and depersonalized that these movements are just look like a mob, but they're not.
Mm. Yeah, and that, of course, serves the people that are doing of these movements. Like, if you go to the ADL website or Canary Mission or whatever, there'll be a long detail, like connected inner, you know, web, connect the dots of this person talked to this person and said this and whatever. So that's actually the murkiness in the popular media. And then in these sites that are tracking and monitoring people, that's one of the only places where people would find something that resembles history to them. So it probably gives them a sense of weight or solidity or truth when they go and see a site like that, unfortunately, because there's no other option there. So, yeah. One of the things I was thinking about with the creation opening up, one of the things that's been really inspiring is, as you said, that the tactics of oppression and repression aren't actually working in the same way anymore. Because I think usually we tend to think that certain tactics that we use to resist become outmoded, outdated, don't become useful, but also the oppressive and repressive apparatuses also become, and tactics also become outdated and outmoded. And so I'm thinking about that. And I've been so inspired by the people that have decided to leave when they're silenced and just say, well, I'll create my own press. I'll get my own group together. I'll start an art collective or initiative or a gallery, whatever. These things where people have decided to say, I'm going to create my own, because it seems that creating good has to be part of this as well. So that there are places for, there are places for things to flow as the resistance is underway as well. So I don't know if, I actually don't know what it's like in New York City right now, and how that's playing out with people creating new things. In Ireland, it's actually not quite as necessary, because there is like mass, large solidarity with Palestinians.
We're midway. I mean, like I said, we're in the middle of the shift, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, the other side's rhetoric is illogical. Like Chuck Schumer, the senator of New York, gave a speech, a national speech on anti-Semitism the other day. His niece is Amy Schumer, who gave a similar speech. And their argument is, Jews are alone. I'm like, alone? Your side is getting billions of dollars from the U.S. government. All of our tax money is not going to housing and healthcare. That's all being sacrificed to pay for Israeli weapons. How can you say that you're alone? Mm-hmm. It's so dishonest and untrue. Mm-hmm. And that's all they've got. They don't have anything that's true to say. Mm-hmm. So that's where they are right now.
Yeah. I mean, that's been something that's really interesting for me, is actually that people bombarded with propaganda right now continue to engage in mass movements, saying something that looks like actually what matters here is the truth, and the truth does have a moral value to it. The truth is a moral truth, which is that state violence against people is not correct. So you can throw all this shit at me that you want, and while there are debates between whether or not Israel bombed a hospital, that now seems like distant debate, because now they continue to do it. The fact remains that the state should not be exacting violence against people. And
right. The argument used to be that, I mean, my primary argument around Israel was that I don't believe that people should have different levels of rights because of their religion.
Yeah.
Now it's like, I don't believe 12,000 people should be slaughtered.
Right.
It's on a completely other level.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious. That's the thing. That's why you're getting a million people in the streets in London. Because no matter what the governments say, we see.
Yeah. So picking up that and just talking about repair a little bit. I mean, I've been sort of, you know, all along, I've been really happy for the amount of people that have been kind of awakening to the truth of what's happening, mm-hmm. and has been happening, and saying, you know, look, if you've believed that Israel was this great place and Arabs were savages your whole life, and you're starting to understand now, please come, you know, your change and your voice and your reconsideration really does matter here. Some people will still be pissed off at you. Some people will never forgive you for having this view for a long time, but it doesn't matter. Like, what you're doing now and bringing that voice forward and your new understanding really does matter. And I think that that's really important. And there are people that are seeing the images of Palestinians being killed, accept them as true. They don't think it's Palestinian propaganda, and are not having any kind of changed experience. And so it's leaving me in this place of wondering, you know, where does that, do I hold out hope for those people? I mean, ultimately the answer is yes. That change can come at any time, a radical change.
Yeah, but you don't need everybody. You just need a critical mass.
I'm not thinking about it in terms of the movement. Sorry, just to say.
Okay.
More like what comes next for contending with the people that looked into that atrocity and were not only unmoved, but actually enlivened by it or invigorated by it. And I'm not talking about people who are in the IDF or people who are actively contributing on a physical or material conditions level, but just the amount of people who are, you know, just looking upon it and saying things publicly or whatever. I'm having trouble navigating that a little bit for
who are you talking about? Be specific.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the origins of this anxiety start way before this, you know, having lived in LA for a long time and just having confrontational conversations with people that I knew had seen what was happening. But now I'm just thinking of people either online or actors and actresses, writers, musicians, who seem to be taking in the imagery that's not moving them. It's not I'm not talking about Amy Schumer, who's obviously related to someone who has a political investment in the case, but other, you know, other people who don't seem to as much.
That's the way it is.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm wondering what's where the I don't know, say aftermath or fallout. I don't exactly even know what the aftermath or fallout of this looks like or when it occurs. But because I'm thinking about things in terms of I guess maybe in saying that's just the way it is, are you saying ultimately you can't really do anything about their insensitivity to the issue, and if it's not moving the political field, then it doesn't matter in a sense?
Well, that's what I said before, but you can never get everybody. Mm-hmm. But if you want to make change, you just need a critical mass. And you have, you know, there's people who are never going to come around on abortion, never. Mm-hmm. But you have to fight them. It's a power struggle. And, you know, there's always going to be people who are racist or who love violence or have supremacist ideas about themselves. And that's never going to change. But you want to get a grip on the decision-making process so that their point of view doesn't triumph. That's why it's forever.
Mm-hmm. Why the conflict and struggle and power struggle will be forever.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it has different playing fields. You know, in my lifetime, I've been involved with it, the same struggle on a number of different fields. Mm-hmm. So in the 70s, I was in the reproductive rights movement. I was in the gay liberation movement. I was in the AIDS activist movement. I'm in the Palestine solidarity movement. But these are trajectories, as JVP is showing by using the ACT UP playbook. It's a very long trajectory about who's going to decide the structures under which people live, even if you're an anarchist. Mm-hmm. It's for life, mm-hmm. hopefully.
Yeah, so that would be that's the position of it's saying that's part. I'm just trying to understand. Maybe it seems obvious to you, but it doesn't completely seem obvious to me. I'm just trying to understand. So the position, I mean, it sounds psychoanalytical in a way where it's like, look, these kinds of struggles are just actually part of being human, and they will just continue on and on and on and on. And the thing to do is to realize that it's part of life and therefore understand how to rise up to the occasion.
Right. We have responsibilities to each other until we're dead. Those things go away. Yeah.
I think my struggle with that internally is like, I want there to be different responsibilities to each other. Not that I don't want responsibilities to each other, but you know, the idea of liberating ourselves from some responsibilities and into other ones would be really great.
Well, not everyone. I mean, people go in and out. It's just normal.
Yeah.
Not everyone's on duty all the time.
Yeah.
But there are times when more people understand.
Do you have like a feeling about abolitionists aims then? So if the aim is like to, you know, get rid of police, get rid of prisons, that kind of stuff, do you think that those aims are political aims that have achievable ends? Or do you then think that like the shift of who represents police and who represents punitive incarceration just kind of move into a different field of the social organism?
I think that there's two trajectories historically. There's reformists and utopians. Like if you use the United States as an example, because that's the history I know the best, you have the utopian movements like utopian socialists of the 1840s or anarchists of the 1920s, the communist movement in the 1930s, hippies, gay liberation, black power. These are utopian movements. Then you have reform movements like ending slavery, getting women the vote, making abortion legal, AIDS activism, gay rights, black civil rights. Those are reform movements. Mm-hmm. Society moves forward when you have both. So when you have a utopian movement and you have a reform movement that are dynamic with each other, that's when we advance. Because you have to have concrete demands. Mm-hmm. If your movement doesn't have concrete demands, it will dissipate. Because movements need victories to cohere. But if all you're doing are concrete demands and you don't have a vision, then you become co-opted and bureaucratic. So that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I had to repeat again and again and again when I was doing a lot of sex workers' rights organizing and activism was like, we can't just keep saying sex work is work, but we have to say it now. Like, I can't keep funneling all my energy and vision into the idea of legitimizing one form of work and, you know, and thereby deepening our connection to the wage labor relationship, which is ultimately oppressive. But I do like have to also have a bigger vision where sex is liberated and like work in this form is dissolved. And it was really hard. It was harder for me, I guess, because I was in the activism circle or group to bring the big idea than it was to bring the smaller one that was what was right in front of us. And it's something that I find again and again that with a lot of people that are doing real on the ground work to bring the vision that like, well, as soon as we accomplish this, we actually have to move past it like right away. That's been really hard, you know, for me to talk about. Like I talked with Kathy Weeks on the show not too long ago and we had a long discussion about UBI and I was like, Universal Basic Income. Oh. And she's very much in favor of it. And I was like, well, I'm all for it as long as we get rid of it as soon as we get it. And it was, you know, the same feeling I had about gay marriage, the same feeling I've had about lots of other things. Like we can have these discussions, but there does seem to be this, once you get in, this obstructive aspect to letting the bigger vision in.
Yeah, but universal basic income is not the winnable demand. That is the large utopian vision.
Not
the winnable demand is I want to raise minimum wage.
Yeah.
Or I want more public housing. Those are the winnable concrete demands that are part of that larger vision.
Yeah.
My concern is not having enough concrete winnable demands.
Uh-huh. That's funny. So I guess we're coming at it from the other.
That's why movements dissipate.
Yeah.
That's why they fall apart. Like if Occupy Wall Street had one demand and it was get rid of student debt, it would have become an incredible movement. But because they could never demand anything, they fell apart.
And so when I look at that example, I'm so inspired by the fact that it had no demands because I thought that the connective force and everything that came from not having the demand brought together so many people, so many movements, so many ideas.
To do what, though?
Well, that infuse us to lay the foundation for future work. So I think that some of the things that are happening now do seem to have been born out of that time. I mean,
I don't see that.
No, you don't.
No.
That's funny. And
but,
I think
so I look at what's happening now and I see, I'm looking back to where did it come from? It comes from all this groundwork that Palestinian organizations have done, that solidarity organizations have done, and that direct action organizations have done. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything from Occupy Wall Street showing itself in the response to Palestine.
But when I say now, I mean, I was including that, but I was also just including a lot of other social movements, but also the broad consciousness, political consciousness. It seems to me that certain words and ideas entered into the lexicon after that
time. Right, like the 1%. Yeah.
1%, just more conversation about capitalism to begin with. I mean, that was something that when I was younger, was just not available to public consciousness. Well, it was available, but wasn't accessible inwardly for a lot of people. So I think it was, I think it's that kind of stuff. But that's, I understand saying that that's actually very, it's so diffuse that it'd be hard to pinpoint it. And it is just a feeling. I can't give you the best evidence of how it all spiraled out. I think I could probably find some people that were, you know, big presences in those movements that would talk about, you know, it, but that would be the best I could do, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I wanted to talk about art a little bit, and I wanted to talk about writing and something that I have read and noticed in your work about the mention of of formal innovation in art. And I was thinking about it because I think, do you think that there's some kind of moral quality to formal innovation in writing?
No, there's the method, mm-hmm. and then there's the content and meaning. And I know that some people define meaning to is their meaning. I'm sophisticated to that. So I look at a work, let me think of an example. X by Catherine Lacey.
Okay.
I'm sympathetic to her method. You know, she has interesting ideas. The content of what she's produced is antithetical to the stated intention of the book. So it's a misrepresentation of lesbian life. Mm. Another example would be of the opposite is like a book like Sketch to See by Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, which is a book I adore. And there, the formal innovation of the way Matilda writes, where when the characters are high, we're high. When the characters are dancing, we're dancing. That the work doesn't, the method doesn't describe the emotional life of the characters. It evokes it formally. That to me is very successful. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that it's morally or ethically superior to someone who can do the same thing beautifully with a conventional narrative structure. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one of the problems. Avant-garde work is disadvantaged in the corporate marketplace because it's not as easily commodified, but that doesn't mean it is inherently superior. Mm-hmm. And the avant-garde often makes arguments for formal innovation as superior, but it's not. You can make amazing work in any form.
Yeah, I tried to think of, you know, I tried to think of with my novel that, you know, I was trying to communicate. There's one, maybe two sort of formal, innovative, like flourishes in the book. But I tried to think of the kind of standard narrative as having some kind of, some kind of communication with a reader who wasn't able to go there. Now, of course, they would be able to go there. They would be able to deal with something that was more quote unquote experimental or formally innovative. But I was also thinking, you know, the more standard narrative for me was a constraint that I had to try to engage with as an act of compassion. Like if I wrote things in a very sort of straight expected kind of narrative, and then moved into the innovation, it would cause a sort of shock to the reader. And I was really interested in that. But I think that there's like a, because I enjoy, you know, my main writing teacher was a woman, Susan Steinberg, who.
Was who?
Susan Steinberg.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah. And all her stories and novels have this real formal, they're interesting formally, and I love them. And they created for me always a sense of really super intense claustrophobia, or in her novel, maybe an opening up in a way. So I can really appreciate it, but I also see how and why people reject those kinds of narratives. And so I was just
sort of a lot of it is how much control do you actually have?
How much control do you have over the, as a writer or as a reader?
Well, it's like people who write bestsellers, you know, people who write for the middle market or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I have this friend, Rochelle Feinstein, who is a wise woman in her 70s. She's a painter, and I really look up to her. And she always says, artists work to their capacity, which is actually a very biting statement. Because what she means is, if the people who write for the market or who create middle brow literature or whatever, if they could make something transcendent, they would. They do that because it's the best that they can do. And when you meet people who write middle brow stuff, it's a certain kind of person. I've tried to write a bestseller. It's not going to happen. I don't know how to do it. And those people, that's who they are. So it's not so much a decision. Like, a lot of times when people write experimental work, they act like it's a choice. But for a lot of those people, it's the only way they can write.
Mm. Yeah, I'm thinking about your, does gentrification of the mind starts with you going to, you're in LA, right? Trying to write for movies. And I was trying to imagine how that would, frankly, how that would work for you. Like, what exactly you're trying. I mean, I guess if you write, if you write for theater, because I learned how to write also from just reading tons of plays. Unfortunately, you know, I've not lived in such a theater-rich place as New York City, but I would read a lot of plays and I saw the, you know, the growing typical three-act structure. And that's, in some sense, I suppose, what Hollywood wants from you. So I thought, I was trying to sort of negotiate in my head that way. I was like, well, maybe... since she probably really knew and had that down, maybe she went and like could navigate that kind of conversation that way.
The theater operates on a different thing and it's always changing, but you know, I'm in New York and I've been going to the theater a lot. And so there's been a push towards demographic diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, 12% of plays were written by women. I'm talking about like 5 years ago. And now it's like 40%. Mm-hmm. Or there's more plays by people of color than ever, right? But when you see the plays that are selected, they're not that different than the plays that exist, the white male plays that existed before. They tend to not have much content. The meanings tend to be predictable. They tend not to be threatening to the power structure. So it's like the Nikki Haley phenomena. You know, the Koch brothers just announced that they're endorsing Nikki Haley. And it's like, yeah, if you say what the dominant culture wants, it really doesn't matter if you're a woman and person of color. They as long as your content is their content, now we're in an environment where they can love you. So that's kind of what the theater is. The challenge is to get something produced that actually is about something, which is almost impossible. And I've seen a bunch of things that are incredibly well made. I mean, exquisitely well made, but they're about nothing. Because, you know, we're in a, as Jim Hubbard always says, it's a country with freedom of speech and a country of no ideas. Yeah. And that's how the theater operates.
I want to ask you about that real quickly, because when you're teaching creative writing, I mean, that was... I went to UMass for creative writing, and that was sort of the idea. I'm sure it is in a lot of MFA programs. It was like, whatever story you have to write, it's worth writing as long as you can write it well. And that was always a conflict between myself and my professors then, because my thought was, no, that's not true. It's not, it's not that every story, maybe every story can be told at a dinner party or something like that, but does every story deserve to be centered in creative work? And this was actually became quite a bitter conflict with one of my white straight male professors
who was
Chris Batchelder, who also
never heard of him.
Yeah, he's a fiction writer. He has a few books out. Also took a line from one of my stories and put in one of his stories. I mean, it was just bad, and it was not a good experience. And it was because of that. I thought that idea itself has a problem. And you're saying, I mean, I agree with what you just said. I don't know how you mediate that in the classroom. And I'd be interested actually in hearing.
It's really
that.
Hard because I was a CUNY for 25 years and I loved my students so much. And then I've been doing all this community-based teaching for decades. you know, workshops in my apartment, teaching for the Queer Art Mentorship, the Lambda Emerging Writers, Provincetown, Fine Arts, all this stuff. I love all those students. I just took a job at Northwestern. I started last year. I arrive, first time ever in the corporate framework. And I've got two toxic students of the kind I have never had in my entire fucking life. And I couldn't believe it. I have never been so disrespected in the classroom, ever. So what I realized is we had to change what kind of people we were admitting to the program. Because it's a three-year fully funded program with a $35,000 a year stipend plus health insurance. It's an MFA and MA. And Chicago is cheap enough that you can live on $35,000 a year. So why are we getting ruling class toxic assholes?
What is the toxicity? How is that expressed?
People with nothing, grappling with nothing that matters, and monologuing about the Frankfurt School. Pontificating, trying to take over, threatening women professors, being threatened by having female professors. I mean, the most basic straight male asshole behavior that, you know, I haven't encountered in years because I'm not around white straight men because I've been a CUNY. So, and here he was and his girlfriend. And then he would, like, women would say things and he would say, as she said, and then he would restate it completely. So it had nothing to do with what she said every single class. This type of thing that I, you know, I'm not exposed to that kind of behavior. So what I realized is that the way that we'd been enrolling students was passively waiting for the applications to come in and then selecting. And that is wrong. You need to recruit.
Right. Yeah.
So then I went out and recruited from, you know, CUNY, from Pilsen, which is the Mexican neighborhood in Chicago, from the Palestine Rights Conference. And in 1 year, we turned over who the students were. But it's like you have to be active because so just to get back to your original point, it's not my job to facilitate people producing work that is, to me, antisocial. I am not a social worker. I'm not a mommy. I'm not there to help some asshole make terrible work that is prejudicial and get it in the world. That's not what I want to do with my life. I want to help people who are trying to write work that the world needs and who are grappling with things that matter. So as a teacher, I'm exercising that discernment. Some people feel that they have to help everybody, no matter how destructive the work is. I do not feel that way.
Well, first of all, I've never heard of any school doing that. I'm sure they do, but the surprise to me to even hear you say that, I mean, I suppose maybe I'm a little naive then, that that a school would try and go and find students, because that was definitely the experience of my MFA, was that there was a kind of passive reception of whoever, you know, kind of made the cut. And then, of course, that means it ends up meaning nothing, because the professors there read one story, which could be the best thing that that person is ever capable of producing, and letting them into the program. But I think, so I think, first of all, that's that makes sense. But also, I wonder, though, about the, so you think that you don't actually even have to do this work quite as much of saying, look, actually, what you're writing about, it's so obvious, but like, it's just not done in MFA programs very often, as far as I can tell. Actually, what you're writing about matters. So we're not just going to continuously have a craft conversation.
Right. Even though, we need to have a conversation, not you and I, but there's 54 fully funded MFA programs.
Yeah.
And we do not communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. We need to all get in a room and say, what are our values? What kind of work do we think America needs? Yeah. Because the impact of MFA programs on publishing is so toxic. It's horrible.
Totally horrible.
You know, we need to take some responsibility with that. And this is one of my future projects. It's not for right now. I'm going to do it in 2 years.
It's very needed. I mean, I think, remember there was that book MFA versus NYC that came out a while ago. And I just thought, well, and it was like comparing two paths to becoming a writer, and obviously sort of favoring just going to New York and trying to make it, Which, I mean, that's a great way, but like who, it's not easy for a lot of people, and actually finding a place in an MFA is really a great way to just focus on writing for a few years if you're funded. But I did think like the New York scene of writers, which is also permeated in a lot of ways with people who have done MFAs and who retain that kind of cliquishness of the MFA program. But when I see, some of the people that have come from Iowa and how bland their writing is, and how a lot of them have formed what I consider to be quite a milquetoast writing literati. For me, you're right. The toxic impact that it has on a kind of smoothing out of form, but also this cliquishness that permeates the publishing industry of, who's connected to whom. I think, you really rightly point out the idea when you go to an MFA is that you'll have a professor who helps you forever. And of course, that really does change the landscape of which voices.
Yeah, but I didn't even have that experience. I had the incredibly classic and yet never had before experience of the straight white man who cannot take authority from a gay woman.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was shocked. I just wasn't used to that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, you're an idiot, because I'm actually a great teacher and I know a lot. And here you are in my classroom and all you're doing is resisting me. You're a fool. That's really what I felt.
I was thinking about The Child, and it's one of my favorite of your books.
Thank you. I feel the same. Thank
you. It's very good. It's very tense. It's still funny sometimes, but it's also just very, very, very tense. And I was thinking about how some of the concepts that I see in your later writing appeared in there. And then also in People in Trouble, I saw some of them. So like in The Child, I'm more specifically thinking about the shunning that happens in that novel and how it appeared later in your consideration and reflection and Conflict Is Not Abuse. And so I was thinking about how it's interesting. I think people tend to think that their nonfiction essayistic things would appear in their novels. But as you're writing novels, it seems to rise up and then appear later in nonfiction work. And I'm wondering how that process.
I don't know. Grace Paley said that writers choose their themes when they're very young and they work them all their lives.
Grace Paley, who told you to leave the program.
Yes. I love her. She saved my life. She's my hero.
Yeah.
Because she knew that program would destroy me. So maybe she's right. We're just grappling with stuff. I mean, The Child is very autobiographical. Mm-hmm. And because I have nieces and nephews I've never met. Mm. And I had a father who screamed at me that I was terrible and you're wrong. You're a wrong kid, all this kind of thing. So it's extremely autobiographical, that book. So that's one of the reasons I think it works so well. But then, fiction is sort of for expression, but these nonfiction books are more about trying to understand why. So the books about homophobia in the family, when I wrote that book, Ties That Bind Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences, that was the first time I was looking at the group, the negative group relationship, the homophobic family, bonds around hating the queer family member there, and that elevates them. So they're good and they're connected, and the bad, bad person is this queer family member who needs to be removed. But the actual problem is not the queer family member, it's the family's homophobia is the actual problem. That group analysis that came out of that book is the basis of Conflict Is Not Abuse and the whole idea of the negative group that bonds around blaming or shunning another figure. And I was able to extend that all the way to the way people with AIDS and Palestinians are treated, because I saw it was the same structure. But first I had to articulate it around the homophobic family. And then over time, as I started to think more and understand, I was able to expand it. So that's why it grows that way. It's about deepening and expanding ideas. Because mm-hmm. I'm not one of those people who looks at a pre-existing debate and then weighs in on one side or the other. I don't do that.
Right.
I tend to create I look at the invisible and see the invisible structures hidden in the air, and then I articulate them. And then I build from there. So that's why these ideas expand and expand over the decades.
Yeah. I mean, I find if I'm writing a character and I'm lingering in the compassion and connection that I have to that character, it is evocative whether I agree with their actions or not, you know, which their actions very often surprise me, but it is evocative of a kind of understanding, you know.
Well, that's
That's
about the job of the novelist. And you know that The Child took 10 years to get published, right? Because
I saw that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I think my job as a novelist is to show the way people experience their own lives, not how you think they should experience their lives, not how you wish they would experience their lives, but how they actually do. And it's the authenticity of now lesbian life that is almost impossible to get into print. Because it challenges the dominant group, whether it's gay men who are your editor or whoever is in power, white women, whoever runs publishing, it challenges their sense of themselves as objective and neutral.
Yeah. And so for people who haven't read that novel yet, there's a lesbian couple who is dealing with their own sort of troubles. I'm highlighting this to say that as I was reading it, there's this other through line of the book, which is, you know, the child, this 15-year-old who's had sex with these older men. And I wouldn't have characterized it as having lesbian characters at the forefront until you do this thing where you snap the reader into place just in case they've missed it, where it's like one of the characters, Mary, she's trying to get a play produced, and she's like, look, everybody likes this play, but they just think that, like, you know, they want me to get rid of these two lesbians who are in the back, you know, like also running around in the play, doing their own thing, living their own lives. And they think that they're sort of incidental to the narrative. And as soon as you did that, it kind of snapped me into place. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah. I think I was like also like expecting that in the book. So there is I don't know. I mean, even I think for someone who's an informed or a well-read person, they're going to go in with landing on certain stories. So it was a good corrective.
Well, the weird thing about The Child is that the structure is from John Grisham. It's actually my most commercially written book, except for the content. Because John Grisham novel is, you have two plots. You have the case, and you have the lawyer's personal life. And then they converge. When I wrote it, I thought I was writing a bestseller. So I wrote this story thinking, I thought this was my breakout book. I really did. But then in 1999, two things happened. The priest sex scandal and internet predator, the creation of the internet predator. And it was all over. I could not publish the fucking thing for 10 years. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's very conventionally structured.
And even the title also has its.
Which, by the way, shows you that structure is not the only thing that matters. Back to the question of avant-garde.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I was going to say that it even has a John Grisham-y kind of title almost. If only you'd put like a little house on the hill with one light on as the cover, everybody would have probably recognized it.
The original title was The Child Killer.
So I wrote a story called The Child Molester, which got published in The Stinging Fly, but they demanded that I change the title. And it was difficult for me at first, but I thought, when I asked them why, they actually said, because Stinging Fly is in Ireland, they said, well, molester is actually just, we're not censoring you. Molester is just a word that nobody uses here or understands here anymore. It won't have the same resonance. And I was like, well, I can't call it the sexual abuser of children. Like, it has a different name. So I just changed it to Tell Someone. But it, you know, I mean, I remember that Matthew Stadler novel, The Sex Offender. And I was like, man, like, that's pretty strong. And I'm glad that, you know, he was able to pull it off. Although I would say not many people remember that novel. I was thinking of People in Trouble, this line, sex had become more than an option. It was an obligation and a responsibility, which is a line that I love, and also an effective living that I struggle with. with what is my obligation and responsibility to have sex and to talk about sex and to think about sex. But I was thinking about the way in which you have identified the queer imagination, queer art as having this pornographic expression. And I agree. I mean, I think, you know, also the imagination itself is pornographic. But I'm thinking about the ways in which pornographic art exists today, and maybe just to respond to that a little bit, because, you know, in porn, where we have still visual media representations of porn on OnlyFans and all that kind of stuff, would you say that, how do I even express this? Like, when I was in porn, it was all movies and scripts and that kind of stuff. And that still certainly exists to some extent. But now it's moved into this different media form. And while I do appreciate what that's offered to workers, I do think that it's been a bit of a denigration of what kind of art is widely available to people through pornography. And I'm just wondering if you're tracking that, or if you've been talking with people about that at all. Because
have you read Daniel Allen Cox's last book?
No.
It's so good. And he talks about this in an interesting way. Do you know his work?
No. Tell me.
Oh, he's great. He's a gay guy from Montreal. He's got 4 books. You know, and he worked in porn, and he was a hustler. And he's a really good writer. Anyway, I don't know. Art doesn't pay. Let's face it. So the idea that you can make money from your artwork, I think, should be trashed. The best thing is to get a job that you can live with, whatever it is, so that if you're dependent on your artwork for your money, then you can only make things that will sell. Mm-hmm. If you have a job you can live with, then you're free to make what's important to you. Mm-hmm. So whether it's whatever the form is, nothing that is about expression and consumption really pays.
That makes me wonder, though, about my own sort of prejudice against the kinds of, you know, porn that people are making now, because people are making on their own. I mean, they're having to create their own business structures, mass amounts of money on their sexual, you know, sexually expressive images and media. And then, of course, when it turns to that, I'm like, oh, well, that's not, is that really, like, is that really the same kind of art as the art I was making when I was making porn? And I'm wondering if it's a labor concern or if it's
it's interesting concern. Because, you know, we started out talking about how people can see what's going on in Palestine because of Twitter. And now every person on earth can look at porn, or not, depending on what country you live in, but every American can look at anything they want, except children, online. So there's a way that these things defy a lot of taboo and provide information false and true. And so perhaps as part of, you know, the whole internet experience. Yeah.
Well, sometimes I wonder if people are just doing OnlyFans because they don't want to put down their phones while they're having sex. You know, it's like that. I actually now have fully eroticized the presence of witnessing the sexual act, which I don't by default have any sort of problem with, but I need to think it through and what that might mean for what that might mean.
Did you ever see the show The Deuce, the HBO series?
No. In fact, I was doing a lot of porn performer activism when that was being made. And Maggie Gyllenhaal, was consulting with she was going to porn sets, which is so good for her because most people don't do that when they make any kind of representation about porn. But it was unclear to me about how much she had actually really talked to people, or if she just kind of went and, you know, silently took a note and then walked out. So you'll have to tell me if you think it was done.
I really loved it.
You did.
Yeah. It was a rare TV thing. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I just watched Boogie Nights with my boyfriend for the first time the other night. And I thought, this is pretty good, you know?
Yeah.
Mostly because unfortunately with most porn narratives, and I don't know if The Deuce does this or not, but whenever people make movies about porn who aren't in porn, it tends to be, here's the thing that looks like the whole fun experience. And then it turns in the middle or the end of the movie. It's like, but here's the dark truth behind all of that. Because we can't stand to actually see the representation of people actually just enjoying sex, you know? Because I guess that's what we go to porn for. The first time I watched porn, gay porn, I was like, whoa, you guys are all like enjoying this and you're calling each other cocksucker and it's not an insult. And it was a porn that was guys fucking in a fact, they took over the factory and fucked their boss. It also had this like class war element early development. Yeah.
Well, you know, I wrote a triple X porn movie. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
It was directed by Cheryl Dunye called Mommy is Coming. It's somewhere out there online. Yeah. You can find it.
When did you do that?
Sometime in the early 2000s. I can't remember what year it was. Jorgen Bruning produced it. Do you know him? He does the Bruce LaBruce movies.
Okay. Yeah. Listen, there are like 8 million other things I want to talk with you about, but I think we'll get a chance at some point anyway, at least if I'm in person. So I just want to thank you for your good works and for this conversation, Sarah Schulman. And thanks everybody for listening.